Welcome back to Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Interesting show coming up for you today. We got a fair amount of music here for you today, and some amount of it will be performed live throughout the show. Compliments of the MSU Community Music School, which is celebrating its 20th anniversary. A lot of you know about the MSU Community Music School. A number of you have participated in it, have studied there. And we've got, I think it's five different musicians all together, reed players, who you will be hearing here, kind of to commemorate the 20th anniversary. And we'll be visiting with some of those folks here in just a little bit. So we look forward to that an awful lot. We learn more about the 10-pound fiddles. 39th anniversary season coming up with Scott Pohl and Sally Potter in just a little bit as well. At the top of our program today, more than 100,000 people have been killed and nearly a quarter of Syria's population has been displaced since the uprising against President Bashar al-Assad began in March 2011. As Secretary of State John Kerry works with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov on negotiations to have President Assad hand over all of his regime's chemical weapons, the war on the ground in Syria continues. Here to give us more of a sense of what's happening inside Syria is Asad al-Saleh. He's an assistant professor at the University of Utah and is writing a book on the conflict called The Historical Dictionary of the Syrian Revolution. Professor al-Saleh was born and raised in Syria. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Welcome to East Lansing. You were born and raised in Syria. You still have a lot of family there. Mm-hmm. Where in Syria are you from?
The eastern part of Syria.
Okay.
In a city called Abu Kamal and scattered basically in a town called Salhiya.
Okay. Abu Kamal.
Abu Kamal means the father of Kamal. Kamal in Arabic means perfection.
Okay. And how is your family doing? You still have quite a few family members there?
I have a big family over there. And, I mean, you ask me how is my family. In general, they are fine. But because of the conflict, I lost some far relatives, two of them last year, and a nephew in last month. So the situation is never safe in Syria, even though my part of the country is far from Damascus. It's like the other side of the ocean.
And what kind of military activity, what kind of fighting has gone on in Abu Kamal?
This year, snipers in the area where the regime has some military bases, and also some air raids. These were the most damaging to the city as well as to other places in the whole region. The regime, because the area is far, couldn't control. 90% of that region is liberated, not under the regime's control. So basically they just send every now and then some aircrafts to drop some explosives or rockets and go back.
But ostensibly, the rebel forces are in control of Abu Kamal?
Yes. However, this is to show you the absurdity of the regime's thinking of a military solution. Abu Kamal is a city, and the rebels are stationed on the roads to Abu Kamal, not in the city, basically.
Okay.
So the air raids come and target the city and not even get close to the rebel checkpoints.
Okay.
Just to show you the blind eye of the regime on how to make any progress, if there any, to maybe regain these areas, which is not going to happen because they lost it and they are trying just to retaliate.
And where do you stand with regard to the Assad regime?
I stood before the revolution against him. I mean, he's a ruthless dictator. Well, before the revolution, he was just a dictator. Back in 2007, there was a referendum to... 2000. There was a referendum for Bashar al-Assad to be the president. Not elections in the sense that there was someone running against him. And I remember when I went there, I took the referendum sheet and I said no, because the question was, do you agree that Bashar al-Assad should be a president, yes or no? And I said no. And I handed it to the people on the box, and they said, they opened it, which was very surprising for me. And they said, what is this? I said, but don't you guys...
You asked me a question and I answered it. What did you say?
I said, okay, maybe I made a mistake. So they gave me another one, and I said...
And you said yes the second time.
So I always hated the dictatorship and the lack of democracy in Syria, because he was imposed by the regime on us.
So with military strikes on the table and now the Russians' attempt at a diplomatic solution, what would you like to see happen?
I would like to see a diplomatic solution, but I don't trust Russians, neither the regime. I mean, they have been doing a very awful role in Syria, supporting Assad when he was just doing the military solution. Now they are trying to say, okay, there is a diplomatic window over there, but it's only because someone somewhere said enough is enough. And that's why when they're trying to, I think, maybe gain some time and put more weight to a diplomatic solution that they are not, I think, interested in.
Do you feel at all confident about the details of the Russians' proposal to lead the Assad regime to surrender its chemical weapons and destroy them?
I haven't seen a proposal, but I've seen the argument that this is something that they can work on.
Are you optimistic about that, and is that a desirable way forward as far as you're concerned?
Mark, look, if the goal is just to get rid of chemical weapons, that's perfect. I mean, they can do that because the regime has been threatened, not because Bashar al-Assad all of a sudden decided, hey, these are awful things to be in possession of, therefore I want to get rid of them. No, this didn't happen without the Obama's administration saying that he should be penalized for doing this. So you should look at it as a reaction to a punishment that was coming, or maybe forthcoming.
You would like to see Assad removed from power?
Of course. That's my position.
How?
It's very complicated, but you ask me, I like to have him removed, but the how is a different story. Because, you know, I'm not in politics that much and not in military studies. But I really think that the idea of leaving Assad in power will lead to more destruction in the country, more killing, and it's not a solution at all.
Would you prefer to see a more vigorous American military response over no involvement at all? Have you thought about that?
What do you mean, no involvement?
U.S. Congress just suddenly decided, look, we're not going to get involved, no way, no how, at least overtly.
Yeah, I would.
Would you prefer the former. You prefer a more vigorous military response than no response.
Exactly.
At all. What do you make of the idea of a no-fly zone?
I wrote like 6 months ago, arguing that this is a very, very necessary move, and the international community has the responsibility to impose that.
And
I have been actually for it since the time when air raids started to target cities and towns in Syria. And I don't know why it's not being the topic, not being the talk of the town, because chemical weapons was just used few times. But military raids, they happen now on a daily basis. And they kill doctors who are like taking care of some field hospitals, they called. Like, this is the last thing that I read from someone who I communicate through the social media. Well, he didn't send it to me, but he posted that his town in Aleppo was just targeted by a military jets, and the hospital, he called it the field hospital, was targeted, and doctors and patients were killed. Because usually now in some areas you don't have a regular hospital because the regime cut off all the services from the areas that were not under his control. So it's just an awful thing to see air jets flying over Syria with nobody intervening and saying, hey, you cannot do that.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Professor Asad al-Saleh, who is visiting East Lansing from the University of Utah. He is an advocate of removing Bashar al-Assad. He's a native Syrian and is an advocate of removing President Assad from power, and is generally a supporter of more vigorous U.S. military intervention in Syria in order to attain that end. If Assad were to go, how do you see the aftermath of that playing out? Would there be a power vacuum, or would the rebel forces clearly prevail? How would that unfold, do you think?
I can just envision that moment where, first of all, people will just be very relaxed that now the regime that killed them, the family that ruled them for 40 years is gone. This will make a huge difference among the people, which matters more than anybody else. Now, speaking of power, and remember, this is as Wajdi Ghanem said about Egypt when they revolted against Mubarak. He said, now we see that the power of people is stronger than people in power.
Okay.
So I envision the power of Syrian people to be more overwhelming than what you call it in a very institutionalized way, government.
Okay.
There would be a vacuum for a while in regard to that.
In your opinion, what happens in your country if the United States opts not to use any military force?
Do you That's see a good question.
Ongoing stalemate?
Yeah.
Do you see one side prevailing?
Not the same way, because not saying that, okay, we will or we might strike Bashar and now they will just back off, it will empower Bashar al-Assad even more, because he will feel that no force on earth can stop him.
Mm-hmm.
Now that the Russians are talking about Syria more aggressively, I would say, I mean, just being very visible, saying, hey, this guy is ours.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about, yeah.
Yeah.
He will be even, again, more empowered to say, okay, well, I'm giving the green light to do whatever I want. Yes, without chemical weapons, and I give you that. The chemical weapons are not that dangerous compared to the other conventional weapons he's using. Yes, they are dangerous because, I mean, they can affect a lot of damage to human lives. But, you know, a rocket can destroy more people.
Human life as well.
Yeah.
We could talk an awful lot more. We have to end it. Asad al-Saleh is an assistant professor at the University of Utah and is writing a book on the conflict called The Historical Dictionary of the Syrian Revolution. Asad al-Saleh will be part of a panel discussion on the Syrian conflict later today, put on by MSU's Muslim Studies program that includes MSU Professor Emeritus Mohammed Ayoub, Juan Cole from the University of Michigan, Professor Abdelmajid Katranji, also on board. The discussion begins at 3 at the International Center here on campus. Thank you for joining us. Thank you. Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. That music you're hearing is coming to you live from members of the MSU Community Music School, Cassandra Hibbard on clarinet and Andrea Warfel on bassoon. And we'll be talking with members of the Community Music School coming up and hearing more of their music here between now and the end of our program. In election season, so-called issue ads have become a predictable feature of the media landscape. Issue ads often don't mention a candidate. Instead, they usually promote or attack an issue. Here's an example of a so-called dark money issue ad. This is from the last campaign season, just months ago. It's directed at Bridget Mary McCormick, who ran for and won a seat on the Michigan Supreme Court. At the end, a graphic comes up saying this is paid for by the Judicial Crisis Network.
June 16th, 2010, the day our life was shattered. My son Joe was taken from me, killed when his unit was attacked by terrorists in Afghanistan. My son selflessly gave his life for this country. So when I heard Bridget McCormick volunteered to represent and help free suspected terrorists, I couldn't believe it. My son's a hero and fought to protect us. Bridget McCormick volunteered to help free a terrorist. How could you?
The groups paying for issue ads aren't subject to the same disclosure requirements as candidate ads. Now, issue ads have flooded judicial elections with many millions of dollars from unidentifiable sources. Critics say it's impossible to know a judge is impartial in the courtroom if it's not clear who helped elect them. Our next guest is one of those critics. Bruce Cortade is president of the State Bar of Michigan. On Wednesday, the State Bar asked for clarification of the status of issue ads by the state's top elections official, Secretary of State Ruth Johnson, and we welcome Bruce Cortade to Current State.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. Clarify for us here what we just heard. We did hear a particular candidate for the Michigan Supreme Court referred to in that ad, and we did hear that the ad was paid for by the Judicial Crisis Network. What about that presentation is your concern?
The concern is that nobody knows who that network is, so nobody knows who paid that money. So you have a judge there who, or in that case a candidate for judge, who's being criticized, and we don't know who it is. So you've got a situation there where the public has no way of knowing, is this her opponent? Is this, you know, who is this?
Well, it must be the Judicial Crisis Network, we can assume, supports somebody other than, philosophically, somebody in opposition to Bridget Mary McCormick.
Right.
We can assume that much, right?
We can assume that, but the real issue that we're facing with these ads is the reason that issue ads were deemed not to be expenditures that had to be reported was that they focused on policy issues. And because they were policy issues, they were protected by the First Amendment. So back in 2004, when Terry Lynn Land was the Secretary of State, she and her attorneys issued this letter that said, based on the law at that time, these were issue ads and we're entitled to free speech. Since then, there have been three United States Supreme Court cases that have peeled that back and we believe basically undercut the underpinnings of that decision.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we're asking Secretary Johnson to revisit that.
I just want to make clear that these get called issue ads, but the names of candidates do get dropped in these things, too. Just because you hear a candidate's name doesn't mean that there isn't dark money or mystery money involved in this thing.
Correct. The quintessential issue ads are contact Congressman X about being fair to our children in education. It doesn't say vote for him, don't vote for him. It lays the issue out there.
Isn't it usually opposition to whatever that person has promoted in the past or where that person is coming from?
Correct.
Yeah.
And the difference in judicial campaigns is that when you think about it, the role of a judge under the Constitution, judges are not supposed to be lobbied on issues. The only lobbying that anybody should do for a judge is in a courtroom when, to the extent that you can argue that a lawyer is lobbying for a position in a particular case, that's done. Otherwise, the judge's role is to apply the law. So there's no policy lobbying required in a judicial election.
Is there another example, Bruce, of a judicial election in Michigan where this situation has played out, in your opinion?
It's played out in a couple of different ways. First of all, over the last 10 years, we watched dark money dramatically increase in judicial elections to the point where in the last Supreme Court election, the one with Justice McCormick's ad, of the roughly $18 million that was spent, you could only identify where roughly $3.4 million of that money came from. Yeah. The rest of it was dark money. And then, even more alarming, in the last Oakland County Circuit Court election, a local election, dark money accounted for $2 million of the $2.7 million spent in that campaign, and it was 99% of it went to two candidates who were taking on a field of five incumbents.
So certainly those proportions, considering this was a state Supreme Court contest, you say that almost $13 million, we do not know where that money came from.
Correct. Okay. It's untraceable.
Okay. So a group may be identified, but we don't know who the members of the group are.
Right.
You cite a few U.S. Supreme Court rulings that you maintain that are important here. And this is why you want Secretary of State Johnson to clarify the situation. Talk to us a little bit more about these national rulings and why they're important.
Okay, yeah, there are three rulings. First was in
Citizens United, I imagine, will be your third.
Right. The first was back in 2007, Federal Election Commission versus Wisconsin Right to Life. That defined what a political ad was, and it said a political ad is considered express advocacy or its functional equivalent if it is susceptible of no reasonable interpretation other than as an appeal to vote for or against a specific candidate. So the political ads were for a specific candidate. Then you came along with Caperton versus Massey Cole in 2008. This is a situation in which a local businessman won a $50 million judgment, and the case is appealed. While the appeal is pending, there's a state Supreme Court election going on. A new justice is elected. Then the case is decided, and the case is overturned by a 3-2 vote. The justice who cast the deciding vote received $3 million in campaign funds from the opponent of the man who won the $50 million judgment. Mm-hmm. Now, the important thing about that is the reason we know that he received the $3 million was West Virginia has disclosure requirements. So the man who lost his judgment was able to identify, wait a minute, you got $3 million from my opponent. I want you to step aside. And the judge wouldn't do it. The U.S. Supreme Court took a look at that and said, Under those facts, that judge's refusal to step aside was a violation of his due process rights. Well, here in Michigan, we don't have those disclosure requirements, so there would be no way for anybody to know that that contribution was made. Mm-hmm. So that's a primary basis. Then you're right. Citizens United was the third of the three cases. And while Citizens United is most widely known for saying that corporations can contribute just like a normal person,
true,
the real importance of that in this decision is that the Supreme Court recognized that the disclosure of contributors to election campaigns is a governmental interest in providing the electorate with information about election-related spending resources. So Citizens United supports the disclosure. So especially in a situation here where, unlike a normal political campaign, where you don't have to worry about, that a politician is going to get lobbied. You know that things like that are going on. In a judicial campaign, you have the right to know, has your judge received money? Should your judge step aside?
We're talking with Bruce Cortade, president of the State Bar of Michigan, who called on Secretary of State Ruth Johnson on Wednesday to clarify the state's policy regarding issue ads in our state. How are the battle lines drawn on this dispute? I take it some parties are opposing this on free speech grounds.
Well, the amazing thing is that according to the latest polls that we've seen, 96% of the general public supports full disclosure in election campaigns. The only resistance that we've seen is frankly from those people who are using dark money, the people who either gather it and distribute it or the people who want to be able to do that. So the
who are those people?
I mean, just dark money. It's
who knows?
Yeah, exactly.
Who knows who those
exactly.
people are?
Yeah.
In yesterday's Free Press, columnist Brian Dickerson wrote the following: "The corrupting potential of so-called dark money is hardly unique to candidates for judicial office, and there is no reason why Secretary of State Johnson should not consider broadening disclosure requirements for other campaign expenditures that masquerade as issues advertising." Does he have a point?
The State Bar of Michigan can only comment and lobby on certain issues. We're a nonpartisan group, and because we are a mandatory bar, which means that anybody who wants to practice law in the state of Michigan has to be a member of us, we can only comment on those issues that affect the administration of justice or access to the courts or our ability to do our jobs. So the State Bar of Michigan and me as its president can't come out and say whether this should apply more broadly or not. I will tell you that the unique difference between a judicial campaign and a political campaign is that whole question about when the judge has to step aside. So I'll leave it to others to argue whether this ought to be more widely interpreted. I will say that I think we make a compelling case for why it should, at a minimum, start with the judicial campaigns.
Secretary Johnson is required to respond. When do you expect a response?
By law, under the Michigan Campaign Finance Act, she has to reply within 45 business days. She can extend that, I believe, by 30 additional days.
Okay.
So we expect a decision then. There's a comment period that starts in about, well, whenever she posts it, it's a 10-day comment period.
Very good. Public comment period.
Yes.
We will watch it closely. Bruce Cortade is president of the State Bar of Michigan. On Wednesday, the State Bar asked for clarification of the status of issue ads by the state's top elections official, Secretary of State Ruth Johnson. Bruce, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Live music this morning from Studio S here at WKAR in East Lansing. Cassandra Hibbard on clarinet and bassoonist Andrea Warfel. And the live music today is all thanks to the MSU Community School of Music, celebrating 20 years this month. We'll visit with the players and with the group's executive director here in just a little bit. East Lansing's long been a hotbed for folk music as well. The city is home to the Great Lakes Folk Festival every year. And for 39 years, 10-pound fiddle has brought great music to town. Sally Potter books concerts for 10-pound fiddle. The season starts tonight with Claudia Schmidt and Dean McGraw at the Unitarian Universalist Church on Grove Street, starting at 8 p.m. And WKAR Scott Pohl talked with her about the plans for this year, and he joins us today on Current State. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Mark. How you doing?
Current Skate with Scott Pohl. Tell me about the work that goes into booking. What is it, 30 or so 10-pound fiddle concerts every year?
That's right. You might know that most or all of their shows are on Friday nights, and Sally Potter tells me that their focus on Friday night concerts fits in well with the travel plans of lots of folk musicians. The big city venues that concentrate on folk music tend to schedule shows on Saturdays, and Sally tells me that it's pretty easy for those artists to get to East Lansing the night before.
Friday nights helps us tremendously. The Old Town School of Folk Music in Chicago, 4 hours away, they book large acts on Saturday. Well, people can fly into O'Hare and get a car and drive to Lansing on Friday, do the gig, wake up and drive back to Chicago on Saturday. We're also, of course, 4 hours from Cleveland. There are people who do acts in Indianapolis, and then sometimes we can double book with the Arc, and so it's only an hour away, and performers like that a lot because they can sleep in. So we are sort of the AAA ball club in the folk realm, but we have really good pitchers every night. We have really wonderful acts that are in the neighborhood that need some work, and we provide the mound and they pitch the game, to use a Tigers analogy. You know, we're close to Toledo. We're in the ballpark of all these other larger venues. You couple that with performers love to play the 10-pound fiddle. So out in the folk realm, when the 10-pound fiddle representatives go to the International Folk Alliance, they go, oh, the 10-pound fiddle. And we get many, many more people who want to play than slots available.
You've got a really nice opening program with Claudia Schmidt and guitarist Dean McGraw. Can you talk about the importance of getting off to a good start with a program like this one?
Well, September is a tricky month in Michigan because I think it's the best month of the year. You get to bring out your cotton sweatshirts and be loose and love this weather of 60 and 70 degrees. It's very hard sometimes to get people into a building to for our first two or three performances in September. But if we bring Claudia Schmidt in, who has hundreds of fans in the area, thousands of fans, and people go, oh, Claudia's coming.
My heart says stop, my heart says go. I see the road and I seem to know just what to do. I'm coming home to you. I'm coming home to you. I'm coming home to you.
Claudia is a fabulous performer. She writes lovely songs. She does performance pieces as well. Spoken word pieces. And then you bring in Dean McGraw, who works with Claudia a lot, and they're on a tour together now through the Midwest. And then Claudia sort of doesn't have to play the guitar. And she gets to be totally Claudia. She gets to talk about pie and spring, and she gets to use her arms and use her body. Meanwhile, this lovely guitarist, who's funny and charming and knows sort of his place on stage because he's sharing the stage with Claudia Schmidt, it's a wonderful duo.
I'm sure we'll talk at greater length with you about the Midwinter Singing Festival when it comes up, but let's spend just a moment on what I consider to be a really exciting aspect of what you have planned for next winter, and that is having a member of Sweet Honey and the Rock in town to not just sing but also to spend other time with friends and fans and people who attend.
We have a lot of help from Goldenrod Music and Susan Fraser. Susan Fraser does a lot of work with Sweet Honey. And so Susan and I started having lunch and just gabbing, and I said, what do we have to do to get Esai here? And I've been to a couple of her all-day singing workshops, and they are very moving experiences, and she is just a master at getting everybody involved and getting it to go right into your heart really soon. And so Susan started working on it. Esai actually has retired from Sweet Honey, so she's doing more and more of this community outreach. She does a community sing once a month in the D.C. area. This is what she does. So Friday night, the song leader is Dr. Esai Barnwell, and she will just hold court with 500 people in the Hannah Community Center. That's January 31st.
I'll be your shelter. I'll be your land. I'll be your everything. I'll be your friend. I'll be your water. When you're thirsty and dry.
Saturday afternoon, we do workshops. She's going to do an all-afternoon workshop called Singing in the African American Tradition, which is an abbreviated version of her all-weekend workshops that she does throughout the country. The people in that workshop will become sort of a festival choir and they will be on stage at the beginning of the second set Saturday night. Saturday night's song leaders are Robin and Linda Williams, with help from Joel Mabus. And the festival choir, led by Dr. Barnwell, will be also involved in Saturday night.
That's Saturday, February 1st. If someone looks at your full schedule and sees some names that maybe they're less familiar with, are there one or two of them that you would like to urge people to consider seeing?
A couple shows this year that I'm really excited about that people might not know about. The Birds of Chicago are sort of the talk of the folk world. There are some listservs out there that talk about bands that are hot. I think they're probably in their early 30s. They write most of their material, but it's deep material, and it says something. And again, it's a guy and a woman and who are married at this point. Their chemistry on stage is magic.
Mountains high through valleys deep, in a restless California sleep. Yeah, my sister came to me and lit my way back to the danger and the love of a July day. Now if you come from where the weather's the worst, you believe in death, you believe in rebirth. Now I'd lost my weather till my sister came and put my head together. She said, you get who you is from who you was, and we don't pass through storms, they pass through us. So if you're stumbling along in some strange sunlight, sing yourself this prayer in lullaby.
Let these clouds correct the air, hush about you worries and cares. For every storm that this way comes, there's the beauty of the moment when the blow is done.
Their physical presence is commanding, and you're just happy to be in the same room with them. So they are coming up actually a week from Friday, September 20th, Birds of Chicago. David Francie is, if you like James Keelahan and you like Garnett Rogers, David Francie is sort of in the same area of folk. He's a singer-songwriter. He did like some manual labor early on in his career. He's the working man's poet, really. But unlike a lot of poets who try to put their words to music and don't quite get it right, David Francie has simple lyrics that say a lot, and he has simple melodies. If you look at the Canadian Folk Festival, David Francie is on the top. He's the top person on the bill of most of the festivals this past summer, and he's coming through the Midwest.
Well, you can find the complete schedule at 10poundfiddle.org. Sally Potter of 10 Pound Fiddle, thank you. Always good to see you. It looks like an exciting season.
Thank you very much.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Music live from Studio S here in East Lansing, performed by members of the MSU Community Music School faculty who have been playing for us all this hour, and we've just heard a flute trio comprised of Maggie Gamble, Tess Miller, and Marissa Olin. As I mentioned earlier, the school's celebrating its 20th anniversary this month. And here to tell us more about the programs offered at the school, Rhonda Buckley, who is the school's executive director and the associate dean for outreach and engagement at the MSU College of Music. Hi, Rhonda.
Hi, Mark.
Nice to see you. Also with us, bassoonist Andrea Warfel, who we heard playing a little bit earlier. This is terrific music, and we're really grateful you're here performing for us today.
Thanks for inviting us.
Sure.
It's nice to be here.
Give us the basics of what the Community Music School offers, Rhonda, and what are your most popular programs?
We have programs for people of all ages, starting with early childhood music education for the babies, infants through seven-year-olds, and classes for youth and adolescents, any instrument. And we also have Suzuki violin for, you know, strings and flute. Suzuki flute is one of the very popular instruments that
there's
we have.
There's a Suzuki flute program?
I've only
ever associated with the strings.
Well, there is. In fact, we have a wonderful faculty member who you just heard play the flute, who is our Suzuki flute teacher.
Oh.
And it's a really cool instrument. The neck curves so that it's reachable for little fingers.
Oh, how interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You've got an aspiring musicians program. Who hasn't aspired to be a musician at one time or another in their life? Who is attracted to your aspiring musicians program?
Well, we are targeting youth grades 5 through 8 in our aspiring musicians program. And we work with these youth primarily from Detroit, actually. This is a program at our Detroit Center, which the university launched in 2009. President Simon had a really, you know, a drive to make sure MSU had a more solid presence in Detroit, and the Community Music School is one of those elements in our MSU Detroit Center. So that's where our aspiring musicians reside.
Andrea, how'd you happen to take up the bassoon?
I started playing bassoon in middle school. It's been a little over 20 years now. I actually started on clarinet and went to my band director to say that I liked to play low, and could I play bass clarinet? And they said, would you like to try bassoon? And I said, but what? And she said, come by Saturday. And so, and it was, it's been a love affair ever since.
Isn't that an advantage of playing one of the more out-of-the-way instruments is you tend to be in a little bit more demand.
Yep, that's true.
Yeah. Yep. Now, how many, when you're playing in a full, have you played in a full orchestra setting?
Yep.
Are you typically the only bassoonist, or are a couple of you?
I've done it different ways. Sometimes in smaller programs, you tend to be the only bassoonist, or one of two. They usually try to have two bassoons, at least. But in orchestras the size that Michigan State has, there's usually four bassoons, sometimes more. I actually did a quick gig with the Lansing Symphony Orchestra a number of years ago. I think they were doing Brahms Requiem, and they needed like six bassoons and a contra, so there were.
My college roommate was a bassoon player, and so I'm really familiar with your mouthpiece is out right now?
Yeah, my vocal, yeah, that's what that part's called.
Okay. I was thinking we might be able to get you to solo here in just a second, but we'll save that. How does your music therapy program work, Rhonda? How do you engage young people with that?
Well, music therapy is a really, really important and popular program, actually, that we have at the Community Music School. It reaches people of all ages, so not just children.
Not just children, okay.
Yeah, people of all ages with all sorts of levels of disability, whether it be closed head injuries or social or emotional issues or, you know, physical issues. And the way that music touches them is just very deep and moving. And healing. I mean, there are miracles that happen through music therapy. We employ 7 music therapists, so we have hundreds of individuals who come to seek therapy through music and have their lives benefit for the better.
Andrea, what has been what's really the sweet spot for you as far as your affiliation with the music school?
I wear 2 hats there. Well, probably more than that. But I actually have a couple of students through the Community Music School, but my main job there is working in the front office. I do the HR and budget work, so I process payroll.
But everybody's a player.
Everybody's a player.
You work in HR, you play
right.
The bassoon.
Yeah.
You know,
it's
that kind of place.
Yep.
What's the most rewarding part of being involved, affiliated with this group?
There's a lot of different aspects. I have young children, and we attend the early childhood classes, and so we find that just for our family to be just an excellent source of entertainment, and often keeps the kids busy in the store, and we sing the songs from the EC classes. And I think seeing the music therapy clients come through, though, in our new building, we're set up much closer to the main entrance, so people come through, we're able to see everybody, and to watch even people who are not music therapy clients, but come in looking a little down and turn around and walk out and seem lifted up from having had a session with a therapist or a lesson with one of our teachers or with our adults in the New Horizons band having had their rehearsal and just getting to see them come out with smiling faces when they may not have walked in that way.
You are so much more visible in your new location. I mean, the new location is working out as far
it's
as you're
beautiful.
Concerned.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Drive by it all the time.
It's and you know, since you drive by it all the time, you might want to stop in and take a music lesson because we offer beginning band for every single individual. If you've always wanted to play the baritone horn or the bassoon or the clarinet, we can take you as a student at the Community Music School through our New Horizons program.
I was a member of your rock camp with Outer Vibe. I'm a horrible electric guitar player, and I wasn't going to let that stop me from getting affiliated with Outer Vibe. We should probably talk for 30 seconds about Outer Vibe and the rock
camp. They're a band out of Grand Rapids, but Lisa Kakos, who is one of the band members, is a graduate from the MSU College of Music, a composition and theory major, and she got us involved with them through their band in collaboration with our students, and now we have annual rock camp at our community music school. They perform at the Common Ground Music Festival. It is so cool. And then we also have the rock workshops for adults, which you have participated in.
I have.
And I have too, and it was really fun. They put you in a band and you learn some tunes with some other, you know, kind of cranky old adults, and
what baby,
it's fun.
What baby boomer has not had the rock star fantasy for at least a few seconds in his life?
And it can all come true.
You can kind of get a little closer to that dream thanks to the rock camp. How has the community music school evolved over the years? What changes have you seen that are most noticeable?
Well, this is our 20th year. In fact, we're celebrating our 20th anniversary starting tomorrow at a tailgate. And we started in the music building with 200 students. We then moved after 10 years to Timber Lane Street in East Lansing, where we were there for another 10 years, and grew into about 2,800 students. And now we're in our new building on Hagedorn Road, where we invite everybody to a free tailgate from 10 till 1 tomorrow to celebrate 20 years. And we're at about 3,000 students a year. So it has grown immensely. We're reaching many adults. We really want to invite our adults who have always wanted to play an instrument to come and join us. It's never too late to start learning.
Yeah. We have a folk program as well.
We have a lot of folk music people listening. Tell us about that.
Well, you know what's wonderful about our new space is it opens up to the community in a much grander way. In fact, we'll be hosting 10-pound fiddle performances. You just heard from Sally Potter.
Yeah.
They'll be performing at CMS. We're able to host some East Lansing Film Festival events. We can collaborate much more broadly with our campus community and with our arts community. So we're super thrilled about our new space. It's bright and cheerful and colorful and lots of parking. We'll accommodate you for parking, so that's not a problem.
But if you're doing tailgates, everybody's got to learn the fight song at one time or another is really what it boils down to.
Absolutely.
Okay. Our German band will be there on Saturday. They're part of the New Horizons group. A few of them get together. They'll be performing, and they were practicing the fight song just the other day.
Okay.
In the building, I heard it.
We want to thank the executive director of the MSU Community Music School, Rhonda Buckley. Best of luck and congratulations on your 20th anniversary. Andrea Warfel, best of luck to you.
Thank you.
And our flute trio, Maggie Gamble, Tess Miller, and Marissa Olin. Many thanks to all of you way over there. They're
thanks
waving.
For having us.
They're waving. Thanks very much. We're going to take a minute today to bid adieu to a member of our WKAR family. A lot of you have come to know and love over the years. Jeannie Krupp's been one of our TV hosts for years during broadcast specials and fundraising and on. She's worked hard in a lot of roles over the years, and part of her title is communications manager. Jeannie, congratulations.
Thank you, Mark. It's a big deal for me.
Yeah,
it's hard, too.
It's a big deal for everybody. 32 years at WKAR, correct?
Yeah, that's right. That's the paid full-time years. Doesn't count student, doesn't count volunteering. It doesn't count watching Classroom 10 when I was a grade school person living in East Lansing.
Okay, yeah, you're a hometown product.
I'm a hometown kid.
What will be the highlight you think that you remember as you look back, once you're out of here and you think back to WKAR, is there a memory that will come to the top?
Well, there are a couple of things that really are kind of a big deal. One to me was that whole digital TV transition. It was a painful transition, and everybody worked together to finally get our digital signal on the air. It took a long time, and it was pretty confusing for a lot of people. And I got to talk to a lot of them and help them out as they were going through that. The thing I think I'll miss most, though, and remember most as I look back, all the incredible people I've worked with here. I mean, you, the radio team, the TV folks, everyone. They're incredibly professional, capable, creative, caring, compassionate individuals, and they are indeed family.
And what's your retirement fantasy? What are you looking forward to most about not being here every day?
Oh, gee, sleeping in a little bit, I think. Cleaning the basement, that's always a plus.
You
doing
know how
some
to
art.
Party.
I do. I'm going to do some art. I want to travel a lot as much as I can and just catch up with people that live kind of everywhere.
Jeannie, we wish you the best. It's been great knowing you for many, many years, and I'm sure I speak for everybody at WKAR when I say that.
It's been my pleasure and privilege.
All the best. Jeannie Krupp, our communications manager and TV host, saying goodbye to WKAR after 32 years. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State Weekend, Superman and Batman are coming to Michigan. But what about the rest of Hollywood? Current State Weekend host Emmanuel Berry takes a look at Michigan's film industry. Also, many Lansing residents know the tale of two brothers who founded the city on a great land scam. Turns out that's all a myth. Find out more tomorrow on Current State Weekend. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks also to producer Emmanuel Berry and to Aaron Young for engineering. We've got members of the MSU Community Music School taking us out today. We thank them again. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR. Take care.